Everyone to
Welcome to this
the
episode of
156th edition of Europe Calling. A special welcome to our four guest speakers and more than 1,000 people who registered from all across Europe to participate today. Special thanks to Jutta Paulus and her team for hosting the webinar today. My name is Maximilian Fries. I'm the director of Europe Calling. I'm your moderator today, and my colleague Amelie is supporting us with questions in the Q&A. Okay, our subject today is the 15th anniversary of the nuclear disaster in Fukushima. And this event highlighted the risks inherent in nuclear power. 15 years later, just to give you an example, there are still tens of thousands of people who are unable to return to their towns and villages because of contamination. Today, we want to talk about a different reactor, the highest output nuclear power plant in Europe, in Zaporizhzhia, in Ukraine. We're going to talk about the role of Russia in this power plant and about global nuclear politics in general and what they mean for European politics. So, really fascinating and a very important day today. So, I'm really looking forward to our input from the speakers and to your questions. Before we get started, a few housekeeping notes. We're going to speak both English and German today, and if you need support with languages, we have interpretation available. So just select the globe icon to select the language you prefer.
Just repeating this quickly in English. We will speak a mix of English and German today. Should you need help with that, you can find the interpretation function under the control panel. There are two wonderful interpreters, and they help you understanding every single word. So thank you very much. Wieder zurück ins Deutsche.
As always, with Europe Calling, we are here for your questions as well, and you can upvote your questions as well. We'll post the Slido link in the chat for you to post questions and upvote other people's questions. We have more than 1,000 registered participants today, so we need your help in upvoting and ranking questions. Please indicate your name as well. That's just much nicer than only having anonymous questions. We always record the Europe Calling editions and we'll upload them on YouTube and as a podcast. So please keep that in mind when asking questions. That's it for my housekeeping notes.
I'm switching to English to introduce our first speaker. It's the Denis Sultanhaliyev. So I messed it up the first time. Denis Sultanhaliyev, senior researcher at the Ukrainian human rights NGO Truthhounds. And since 2014, so the first invasion of Russian forces in the east of Ukraine, Truthhounds documents crimes by the Russian invaders and brings them to public attention. One part of the work focuses on the occupied nuclear power plant in Zaporizhzhia. So Denis, very, very good to have you, and thank you for all your work, and we are very curious to hear what you have to report.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for inviting us for this conversation, and thank you, Maximilian, for your kind words about our work. As Maximilian said, Truthhounds indeed documented war crimes and occupation-related violations since the beginning of Russia's war against Ukraine in 2014. And the seizure of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant on March 4 is the first military occupation of functioning nuclear power plant in history. And also it was followed by occupation of its satellite city, Enerhodar. Presented for us quite experienced team in a occupation policy topic, something we had not previously encountered. The thing is that the central role of a state corporation in structuring and sustaining the whole occupation regime in Energodar. The corporation, Rosatom, embedded itself into city government through several channels. First of all, administrative appointments, then financing of city budget, creating the educational policy, and also, of course, direct control over the plant itself. For example, they created such a specialized atomic classrooms, and they were established in every school in Enerhodar with over 100 graduates signing targeted employment contracts with ZNPP through a Russian-backed training program in Sevastopol. The heads of Energodar Occupational Administration also were drawn directly from Rosatom's managerial ranks. For example, from Rosenergoatom's leadership, which openly acknowledged it is a deliberate corporate policy. So both current mayor of Energodar, Maxim Pucho, and the previous mayor, Eduard Sinovos, they were just bureaucratic workers of Rosatom, which without any relation to Energodar or to region. But it's fine to become a mayor if you're working for a lot of years for Rosatom. It's interesting how unexpected career path in Rosatom could be. So for 15 years, you're working as accountant and project manager in Rosatom, and then they make you a mayor of occupied Ukrainian city. So what we documented in Energodar, not just a military occupation, but systematic conversion of Ukrainian city into Russian nuclear company town ruled by Russian governmental corporation. We also documented at least 226 cases of unlawful detention of civilian residents, including ZNPP employees. Most cases involved torture and inhuman treatment, beating, electrocution, sexual violence, psychological pressure, or threats against family members, fake executions. At least 7 dedicated detention sites were established across small town of Energodar, and constituting what the evidences indicated, it was very deliberate infrastructure control and not just isolated acts of continuous wartime violence. So these violations, they constitute both war crimes and crimes against humanity under international law. And what makes this case distinctive is the documented role of Rosatom in the abuses committed against the civilian population. The corporation operated through 2 parallel tracks. At the plant level, Rosatom representatives oversaw the selection of Ukrainian staff for coercive interviews and participated in those sessions directly. In the city, Rosatom personnel were embedded into occupying administration, directing appointments and budget allocations. So the purpose was quite specific: to force ZNPP workers to sign contract with Rosatom, providing a corporate right for the seizure of Ukrainian state asset. Each cycle of detention tended to escalate in severity, and coercion remained sustained and structured through. Rosatom's active role in the practice engaged question of both state responsibility and corporative liability under the international law. The unlawful confinement and torture of civilians violate the Rome Statute and Geneva Conventions. And available evidence indicates that Rosatom representatives acted at minimum as aiders and abettors of those crimes, with the possibility of co-perpetration in a number of documented cases. And the scale of what happened at ZNPP was made possible by Rosatom's position in global nuclear market. Of course, not just because of that, but we consider that as one of the main factors. The corporation, as you may know, controls approximately 44% of global uranium enrichment capacity and manages nuclear projects in 33 countries. So market presence that translates directly into the financial and, what is even more important, organizational resources right now sustaining the occupation of Energodar, including through profits channeled from European contracts. And what's very important to understand that Rosatom in this story is not a conventional commercial operator, as, for example, some of our colleagues in Europe would like to see. as Russian state corporation combining commercial activity with state functions under Russian law, it operates as an instrument of governmental policy, one that serves diplomatic and military objectives alongside with its declared energy mandate. This is not some analytical inference, but very structural feature of Rosatom. The corporation's legal status enables seamless transition between commercial governance and roles depending on the strategic needs of Russian state. Nuclear safety and human rights are not institutional priorities in their own right. They hold weight only insofar as they serve broader Russian strategic purpose. A plant whose staff operate under coercion and whose ties to an independent regulatory system have been severed cannot meet even the very basic conditions for safe nuclear operation. And the evidence suggested this was not a concern that Rosatom could address. So our central finding is that military diplomatic dimension, not an exception, but a constant feature of Rosatom's activity. At the CNPP, it just simply became very direct and impossible to conceal for Rosatom. So we call attention to a wider implication. In any country or project where Russia's geopolitical or military interests require it, Rosatom resources and presence can be instrumentalized just immediately when Russia will need it. So the corporation's global footprint, not just a commercial asset, but it is a tool of state power, which is available for deployment and for its political and military mission. And just short final observation, the finding of our report concern Rosatom specifically, a state corporation that functions as an instrument of Russian military policy. And it should not be read as an argument against nuclear energy as such, because Ukraine's functioning nuclear power plants continue to provide our half of the country's electricity generation through the 3 years of sustained attacks. Basically, that fact that I can join you now for this conversation, it's because Ukraine has succeeded to stabilize its electricity system, mostly because of our nuclear power plants. So to be fair, the removal of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant from national grid was the single largest reduction in the generating capacity from any individual facility in the course of the war. And consequences, not of nuclear energy, but of seizure by a state that treated civilian power plant as its military asset. So our practical conclusion here is clear. Economic ties with a corporation implicated in war crimes should be severed as quickly as possible. But also we have some theoretical conclusion, and it's already more nuanced. The relationship between nuclear energy and human rights in condition of armed conflict, encompassing both the risks of nuclear incidents, but also the contribution of nuclear generation to civilian resilience. So our theoretical call is call for analysis through technologically neutral lens, with a lot of attention to the ways in which civilian infrastructure is incorporated into military strategies, and also is capable of assessing harm and protection, sometimes even simultaneously. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. That was super interesting. I took a lot of notes, and I believe there are also already quite a few questions for you. Can I just wanna do two maybe follow-up questions that came to my mind, so to understand the situation a bit better. So as you said, so the power plant and how the city they're occupied. So when we speak, you're documenting this. Is that from where you hear from it? Is it from people that report that are currently in the city, or is that from people that have fled into unoccupied Ukraine? So how is the situation there for people also to report and document what's going on?
Thank you for this question. In our last report, which is because we have two reports on this topic, the main source was Syria of interview, 39 interviews with survivors, and including 20 of the ZNPP employees. So most of them, they left territory of the ZNPP in 2023, but some of them also left the territory of Enerhodar a year later, or already in 2024. A lot of them now in Ukraine, some of them across the Europe. Hopefully they all safe now, but also we have our OSINT team, which provided several OSINT investigations about what's going on the plant now, because as you may know, there is informational isolation there. So there are some IAEA mission on the nuclear power plant, but what we heard that even IAEA mission doesn't have a direct access to all the facilities and to bigger and the most important parts of station itself. And what we've heard, of course, Ukrainian personnel cannot leave a station without mandate. But what we've heard, even Russian personnel, which was transported by Rosatom to work on this station, they don't have a right to freely leave the city. So actually, the informational isolation now is quite rough. So to update data is something difficult to do, especially regarding the human rights violations.
Thank you. Just a second follow-up. So, I'm not sure you mentioned it. So, what is Rosatom trying to do with the power plant? Are they trying to get it running again? Because at the moment, it's not. It's just being stabilized that it is, right? So, is what is the aim of what they're doing there?
Yeah, it is being stabilized right now, so it is not producing the energy. But as we know, even for a stabilized nuclear power plant, which is not actively producing energy, there is still a need of a lot of personnel working there. We've heard a lot of rumors regarding the plans of Russia to activate at least two blocks. Our position is that it would be extremely dangerous because there is no cooling down system right now after the Kakhovka dam was destroyed by Russian army. So we also hear, and probably what you probably heard, that American partners are also could be quite interested into producing the energy from ZNPP in the course of Russian-Ukrainian-American negotiations. But our main point here is, in any case and in any scenario, it should be done only if very clear and immediate mechanisms for nuclear safety would be created. And as we know from our colleague, well, I see the Roger here, for example, that it is not technically doable in the nearest future.
Thank you. Wonderful. Well, actually not wonderful. It's horrible, but that was a very good introduction into the topic and in your work. So thank you very much for that. I'm gonna go along with our second speaker. It's Tatiana Kaspersky. She's a researcher at Södertörn University in Stockholm, and she has a quite extensive work on the history of nuclear energy and environmental history in Soviet and post-Soviet areas, as well as in Eastern Europe. And she is here to kind of, you know, I'm very excited to hear what you do about pulling the scope a bit bigger, maybe further than just Zaporizhia and looking at the use of the atom nuclear energy in times of war. So Tatiana, so great to have you with us. You have the floor.
First of all, I need to say that I really want to say thank you to Denise and Truth Hounds for the amazing work they do. I'm a big fan, and I'm very honored to be on the same podium with you tonight. And I will pick up on a few points that Denise mentioned, probably, and develop them a bit more, and also put probably a different emphasis. And I'm starting with this picture of the occupied Zaporizhia nuclear power plant to make the main point of my presentation clear. So in the last two decades, we can say that Russia has developed rather aggressively both civilian and military nuclear technologies, and tried to increase its presence on the international markets for nuclear technologies. And today we're talking more about civilian nuclear energy, but what I wanted to make clear is that civilian and military nuclear technologies are very closely interconnected. They're interconnected since the dawn of atomic age and everywhere in the world, but particularly so in the Russian case. And during the Soviet times, Soviet Union was still pretending that it was mostly interested in the peaceful atom, and that it's only belligerent West and the USA that were interested in nuclear weapons. But with Putin regime, there is no longer even pretense to separate the two. And the use of civilian nuclear sites, Zaporizhia, but also other sites in Ukraine for military purposes, is a frightening, very frightening new manifestation of this interconnection of the peaceful and not so peaceful atom. So I would like to sort of develop more this connection of civilian and military aspects and in Rosatom's activities. First of all, civilian and military nuclear technologies are tightly interconnected in the same institution of Rosatom. Rosatom is this huge state corporation created in 2007, and there are 350 enterprises that do activities both in production of nuclear energy and production of nuclear weapons. It operates reactors. It's responsible for all the parts of the nuclear fuel cycle. Rosatom also maintains the world's only nuclear icebreaker fleet and nuclear submarines. And just to give you one example, which would be different from Zaporizhia, of the interconnections of civilian military aspects in Rosatom's activities, this ongoing nuclearization of the Arctic that Russian state with Rosatom conducts now. And they're developing this project of Northern Sea Route revived by Putin, but that existed since the 1930s. For the extraction of gas and oil, first, which also helped to fuel the war, but also to increase nuclear presence in the Arctic, to develop the or refurbish some military nuclear bases, to refurbish and prepare for the test site in Novaya Zemlya, and so on and so forth. Rosatom also, as Denise mentioned is a huge presence on the international markets of nuclear technologies. First of all, probably the best known part of this is that Rosatom builds reactors both at home and abroad. And currently there are around 20 of reactors under construction, and there are also many more agreements and the memorandum of understanding construction of other reactors in Asia and Africa, and probably even in Latin America. And Rosatom under Putin has really aggressively pursued this dominance on the international market of nuclear technology, with this idea to make countries more dependable on Russian nuclear technologies, which of course it's always seeks to translate into political influence, and quite successfully. When we say, we can say, for instance, that in Europe there are around 20 reactors, and that not including Ukraine, which is also in Europe, and then 15 reactors in Ukraine, reactors of Russian or Soviet design. There's a pressurized water reactors called VVER. And these reactors require quite specific fuel, which for many decades was produced only by Russian and Soviet company, which is now called TWEL, also part of Rosatom. And Ukraine was actually the first countries that was really implementing the diversification of fuel supplies, trying to develop together with the Western House a fuel that would go in these reactors. It was a very long and painful process, and now Europe also pursues it, this process for other reactors in Europe. But the dependency is still huge. Probably less visible dependencies on enriched uranium and the services of enrichment that goes in this and other fuel, and also on natural uranium. So Russia, of course, actively uses this nuclear technologies to try to dissuade countries of and to support in Ukraine, and that's one of the reasons why there is no meaningful sanctions against Rosatom on a European level. And I do think that European policymakers are somewhat conscious that there is this problem with nuclear fuel dependency, even if it's not so present in the public discussion. And yet we still see the business as usual going on in some project. For instance, there is this project of Framatome that has this fuel production, nuclear fuel production facility in Lingen, Germany. And since 3 years ago, it's pursuing a project in cooperation with Rosatom to extend this facility to be able to produce the fuel for those pressurized water reactor of Soviet Russian design. And this project was not given yet green light, and there are fortunately a lot of protests, and several NGOs are doing great work to make it obvious. But the fact that it's such project could still be considered is really quite frightening. So we saw yesterday, we heard yesterday European Commission chief Ursula von der Leyen telling that on the Nuclear Energy Forum in Paris that renewables and nuclear should be the basis of energy independency and security and stability in Europe, and that Europe should never have turned back to nuclear energy. But I really wonder what kind of stability and security and independence we will get with the nuclear industry, which is so dependent on Russia and which is actually seeking to build through its nuclear diplomacy a much less stable geopolitical order. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Lingen is actually not that far away from where I'm standing right now here in Düsseldorf. Well, this is still some distance, but not that far away. And it's a very important place here also for the anti-nuclear movement in Germany. So thank you very much for that. Thank you for pulling the picture wider and getting us deeper into these dependencies as well. I think that fit very well together. And we now hear our third speaker, who's Roger Spautz. He's the head of nuclear campaign at Greenpeace Luxembourg and Greenpeace France. He has been with Greenpeace for almost 40 years, which has realized that he's probably as long with Greenpeace as I live. So so that's very interesting. And he even, Roger, you said you co-founded Greenpeace Luxembourg back in the 80s. So someone who really knows all the ins and outs, has lived through the Chernobyl catastrophe that many in my parents' generation still remember. And all the more reason to have you here. And we are very eager to hear what you have to say. Roger, please.
Good evening, and thank you much for you inviting you. My presentation will be mainly about the continued business between the French nuclear industry or France and Russia or Rosatom. So it's a quite controversial issue that, because on the one hand, France supports Ukraine against the invasion, the Russian invasion, and on the other hand, France and the French nuclear industry is still doing business with Rosatom or with Russia. Let's see where next. Okay. I will continue where Tatiana ended the nuclear energy summit that took place yesterday in Paris. Where especially also on the slide you see on the right side, the picture, Ursula Lyon, who talked about global energy security, and the discussions were, the presentations were, how to develop nuclear energy in Europe or in the world, and to become more independent. But clearly, our position is that nuclear power is energy insecurity, and it makes countries dependent on those countries that have uranium mines that enrich uranium and that produce nuclear fuels. And one of the main countries is Russia, with its nuclear branch or industry, Rosatom. Just briefly, the so-called nuclear fuel cycle, which is not a cycle because you have waste is produced as at every step. You at the beginning you have natural uranium, which is, you have to uranium mines only in several countries around the world, some in Russia, Kazakhstan, Canada, Australia, and so on, Niger, but you can't find uranium everywhere. The natural uranium is converted, then it's enriched, and then you produce the nuclear fuel with it. It's used in the nuclear reactors. The used fuel is, in the French case, it's either stored near the production sites, or for the French case, it's reprocessed in Le Hague, on the French coast, where plutonium is separated, which can be used once in a new fuel, which is called MOX fuel, or you separate also in Le Hague the reprocessed, so-called reprocessed uranium, which can be again be transformed and used once again to produce new fuel, which is used in can be used in several reactors. I will not go in all the details, but as mentioned, waste is produced at every step of this transformation and use of nuclear fuel. Briefly, we talked about Rosatom. It was mentioned by Dennis, who is Rosatom. It's a holding with some 300 companies around the world. It was created by Vladimir Putin in 2007. It's not only an economic, it is an economic power, but also as well as a political power. And Rosatom is a company which is under control of the Kremlin. This Rosatom produces nearly 20% of the world's nuclear fuel, also providing an important revenue stream for Moscow, just like other fossil fuels. And then you have one of the companies, the sub-companies is TVEL, the fuel company, which produces nuclear fuel, which has enrichment company capacities, conversion capacities. And they have around 44% of the global enrichment capacities. The French companies that are doing business with Rosatom are, on the one hand, Framatome, which is owned by EDF, Électricité de France, and Mitsubishi Heavy Industries. Majority owner is Électricité de France. Framatome manufactures nuclear fuel, but also they install and construct reactor components, and also, for example, like the instrumentation and control systems, which are installed in several reactors around the globe, and also which are used by Rosatom for their reactors. And as mentioned here in 2021, Framatome and Rosatom, they signed a strategic cooperation agreement for expanding the company's efforts to develop fuel fabrication and INC technologies. And as mentioned by Tatiana, there is a new project discussed, which is advanced nuclear fuels in Lingen in Germany, which want to produce together with Rosatom this hexagonal fuel, which can be used in the VVER reactors. Second company that is doing business with Rosatom is Orano. It's a French multinational nuclear fuel cycle corporation owned by majority by the French state. Orano is, let's say, the chemical branch of the French nuclear industry. It is involved in uranium mining, in uranium conversion and enrichment, and spent fuel recycling. Orano is the second largest uranium producer in the world, with around 9% share in the global uranium production. And then the third company is EDF, Électricité de France, which operates 57 nuclear reactors in France, which are spread out over 18 sites. And the use in one of the reactors in Cruas, the use enriched, reprocessed uranium, and this so-called RAPU, that's reprocessed uranium, which comes from La Hague, from the reprocessing plant, is sent to Seversk in the Tomsk region in Siberia, which is converted and then enriched again to be used as fuel in the Kruyas reactor, and the only plant in the world which can transform this reprocessed uranium is in Russia. Yeah, and a map that we published in end of January, it's the transport routes between France or Europe and Russia. Here you can see the flows. You have mainly uranium mining in Kazakhstan, which can be transported through this route here to Europe, but the main transports go from Kazakhstan either goes natural uranium to the Russian enrichment facilities, or it's transported to St. Petersburg and then transported it either to Rotterdam and Dunkirk, where then again, depending on what uranium it is, natural or enriched, it goes to Malvézy and then to Pierrelatte for second enrichment, and then to Romans-sur-Isère, where the nuclear fuel is produced in France, which is used in French reactors, but also in other reactors around the world. For example, the nuclear fuel that is produced or that is used in the Chinese reactors in Taishan is produced in France. Here again, this picture you see the arrival of one of the ships which came from St. Petersburg. So the traffic, uranium traffic, it's natural uranium. The imports come from Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. Enriched uranium is imported from Russia, and reprocessed uranium is exported to Russia to be transformed and then sent back to France or Europe to produce new fuel. Sanctions against Rosatom. The European Commission and the Commissioner Dan Jurgensen, they presented in May last year a roadmap in which they mentioned that they would also take sanctions against Rosatom or against the Russian nuclear sector. It's also something which the Ukrainian president asked for several times, that these sanctions should be put into place. The roadmap mentioned that the sanctions would be put into place before the end of 2025. So we wrote beginning of the year to the commissioner, asking him for documents, for details about the proposed sanctions. And the reply that we got at this point in time, the Commission has not made any legislative proposal covering the nuclear aspects of the roadmap in question. In the absence of any such Commission proposal, no documents can be provided on any points on your request. Our demands, the Greenpeace demands, are what we call under the French state is the first point is to elucidate the uranium trade. It's still not all the contracts are published. It's difficult to get information, detailed information about the different links between the French industry and Rosatom. Or Russia, about how much uranium under different forms is imported, exported, where the fuel is exported, and so on. So we want more transparency about this trade. For example, nuclear fuel is also produced in Germany, which is then sent to French reactors or reactors around the world. We want to that France, that the three companies, Orano, Framatome, and EDF, and their contracts and or business relationships with Rosatom. We want France to end collaboration between its institutions and Rosatom, and we call also upon France to stop blocking sanctions against Rosatom at European level, because that's the information that we got from Brussels, that especially France and Hungary and some other countries, that they are putting pressure on the European Commission to not put into place sanctions against Rosatom. And the final the slide conclusions, the fuel dependency in the energy sector, Rosatom via Rosatom or Russia via Rosatom commands around 46% of the global uranium enrichment capacity and 20% of conversion services. In in 23, the European utilities sourced around 23% of their uranium directly from Russia, with another 21% coming from Kazakhstan, where Russia or Rosatom has significant stakes in the mines. The central, especially central and eastern European countries like Slovakia, Hungary, the Czech Republic are particularly vulnerable due to their reliance on Russian VVER reactors. Despite efforts to diversify, the European Union remains dependent on Russia for enriched uranium and reactor maintenance, and Russia exerts significant influence over Europe's nuclear sector through dominance in fuel supply.
Thank you very much, Roger. That was very important. Also, kind of in a way, summarizing and extending. It's a very good combination. Thank you very much for that. We have a lot of questions, but we are going to go, also looking at the time, directly to Jutta Paulus. Jutta and her team co-organized, as I said, this event without us. That was their initiative, their idea, and it's always good to have great ideas. And Jutta is a member of the European Parliament, an expert on nuclear energy. And just today and yesterday, she was, at least in German, probably also in European media, criticizing Ursula von der Leyen and Emmanuel Macron's plans for, you know, a revival, or however they call it, of nuclear energy. And, you know, we got some reasons in the last three talks why that might be a bad idea. And I think Jutta will tell us more about this, and maybe also a bit what Ursula von der Leyen and the Commission are actually planning right now, and what on the political level can be done against it if wanted.
Thank you very much, Max. And I'd like to thank our fantastic experts, because you are true experts. I'm not a true expert. I mean, I've just read a lot, and of course, I'm politically active, but for doing my work, it is really significant that there are people out there like you, researchers, disclosing information, putting together research, and so forth. Please go and read the World Nuclear Industry Status Report. It has been published recently, and the global status quo is really well presented. The reactors are online. What is true about the renaissance of nuclear energy? Not much, except for China. The number of reactors is decreasing. If you want to know more, please, it's a really good read. But now I'd like to provide some political context. So we have correctly heard that sanctions are theoretically possible against nuclear technology, Russian uranium, and that the Commission promised to implement sanctions. And I don't see that there are single people who ban it, but that these sanctions have not materialized. Why is that? I believe that's because sanctions are connected to foreign policy, and foreign policy needs to go along with tax policy. For others, you need a qualified majority, but in these areas, you need a unanimous decision. Hence, it was also difficult when it was about Russian gas. Then the Commission always said, all right, I mean, we put out legislation here, and that happened with the gas. It has been passed. So it's now completely banned to buy Russian gas because it is not a reliable supplier. That's true. That's, well, independent of the invasion and the cruelties in Ukraine, and because supply was throttled. And so that gave the Commission some leverage. And we hope the next step will be Russian oil blockage. But when it comes to uranium, I believe it's France mainly that is blocking further steps. They are a strong voice in favor of nuclear energy. Yeah, the energy ministries spoke to the Commission, and yeah, from France, we hear many champion voices. And now Ursula von der Leyen has now joined the choir and said, well, shutting down nuclear power plants was a strategic mistake. And personally, I believe the entire strategy, together with the package that was presented, and that now small nuclear modular reactors are the future, that's nonsense. I mean, it's like a Potemkin village. They are not there. They exist on PowerPoint presentations, but they are nowhere to be seen. Of course, there are 200-300 megawatts reactors. One is a reactor at Alexander Mosinofov. It's a Russian research ship in Siberia. There's one reactor, and we don't know much about it. And there's a second one, supposedly in China, that is usually more idling instead of running because there are plenty of problems. They are far above budget, and others that are still under construction or under planning have already exceeded all budgets, so the investors have left the sinking ship. So it's not a cheap solution. In terms of safety, we've already heard, well, self-reliance is really important, but if we back nuclear energy, we back dependence on Rosatom. And I thought that was really a good illustration. Rosatom has its fingers in all pies. There's a lot of documentation about that there. Of course, we can only briefly touch upon it in this webinar, but we want to get rid of this dependence. And then back to safety, I mean, those small modular reactors are said to be safe, but to be honest, if I were a terrorist, I'd be very happy to find many distributed reactors with material that I can blow up and so on. So, and yeah, in order to reach our climate goals by 2040, 2050, climate neutrality, that's too late. So the Commission just said only in the 30s those small-scale modular reactors could go online. They have offered de-risking funding now to prop up private investments. I've now started legal investigations here because it could infringe on antitrust law and legal contracts. I'm not a legal counsel, so I need to ask experts there as well. But direct subsidies were out of the way anyways. So we still need to find out whether that's possible. Of course, we are very we are increasing the pressure on the Commission in order to raise sanctions. Until now, we have not been successful, but in other contexts, I also try to rally for these topics. I mean, it's impossible that on the one hand, we see how Russia attacks European infrastructure using cyber attacks, and on the other hand, there's the radioactive trafficking, and they learn a lot about European power plants and everything else, all state secrets, and this is a safety risk that is incredible. Last, the WWER that are from the Soviet times are based on the hexagonal fuel delivered by Rosatom. Westinghouse can also produce the same fuel, and why don't we buy from them? Ukraine does it too. But again, EDF, Uranum Framatom, and the others don't want that. Westinghouse is their strongest competitor when it is about new reactors. So the entire business is fishy. There's a lot of corruption, nepotism, and close interlinks with the military, a lot of safety risks. renewable energies are energy of freedoms, and nuclear power plants can never fill this void. So I disagree with Denise. I believe nuclear energy should be banned to the past. Thank you for this final statement. Now there are 30 minutes left for questions and answers. We have 25 questions here, maybe some raised hands in the end. And well, I'll start with the first couple of questions.
I'm probably better switching into English. So we're going to do this discussion in English then, so that it's easier for us to listen to each other without the interpreters, and you can listen to the interpreters as audience. So I'm going to ask the first questions, and then we are looking through and see what we can answer more questions. And the way we do this also to the panelists, so we'll ask a question probably to one or two people, and if you want to add something to it, please just use the hand button and raise your hand. So it's also interactive for your side, because we don't have to answer all the questions, all four of you. Sometimes it's just enough if it's one answer. So right. So maybe, yeah. So Thomas asked here, this is the first question, and that's probably a question, to Jutta and to Roger, I think. So Thomas asked, what background information is there about why von der Leyen is now backing nuclear power? She should know the facts. So Roger, Jutta, why now? Why is Ursula von der Leyen going into this direction now?
Maybe I can give my position. First, also, I think we all know that nuclear power is very expensive to build nuclear reactors. When you look at the costs for the EPRs, which have been built in France, I think the original cost was 3 billion or so. It's now much more. And the nuclear industry is desperately looking for money, also for public money. Private bank normally would not finance the construction of a nuclear power plant. And therefore, France and other countries which build nuclear power plants want to have plans to build nuclear power plants, they need the money. And therefore, one of the possibilities is also to get European money, and that's the pressure which is put on the Commission, on Ursula von der Leyen, and all the deals, how they are done on a political level. I give you this, then you give me that, and that's probably the same position with the position now from Ursula von der Leyen.
Yeah, and I think Jutta, you said then, like in the media reports, and I just want to comment on this. I mean, you said it's like what the Commission is actually talking about is like 100 million, which is not really a lot of money for anything. So is that actually smokes and mirrors happening there?
Well, of course, the Commission is a lot under pressure, right? So we have a right-wing majority in the European Parliament, a stable pro-nuclear majority, regardless of facts, right? Because they simply claim, well, we'll do better next time. And when we build those small modular reactors in series, it will all become frightfully inexpensive. So for me, it's a bit like back to the 50s, right? When the claim was nuclear energy will be too cheap to meter. And also she's under pressure from the member states, because France managed to draw, especially Central and Eastern European member states, to their side. And you have to keep in mind that in these countries, the mindset is we need big central power plants. That used to be coal power plants, which, of course, now is no longer possible due to the climate crisis. So their thinking is, okay, then we simply replace coal with nuclear and we don't have to do anything else. We don't have to deal with all this renewable energy, decentralized small stuff, which we can't handle. Secondly, what a colleague from one of these countries told me, so it's not my invention, I'm simply quoting him. He said, for our countries, handling or being able to handle nuclear energy means we're a big industrialized country. We can handle this high level technology, and building such a site where you invest several billion, maybe it doesn't really, well, if 1 or 2 million just vanish in the process to some friends or relatives, it's not that big of a deal because you're handling billions anyhow. So no one will be able to trace every single million. That was his quote. So it's not my assumption, or I'm not blaming anyone. I'm just telling you what I heard from a colleague from one of these countries. So basically, Ms. von der Leyen has given in to the pressure from the majority of member states and also from the parliament.
But I think this is a very interesting question. I think it saw it also somewhere in the questions. I think it also in the preparation. I'm not sure I read this from Tatiana or from Dennis, but you can maybe both, because Dennis said, you know, one of the reasons also for that, of course, it's something about resilience, right? So the other nuclear power plants that are not occupied, they keep the country running to a big degree. So is this kind of that there is now a majority for more dependence, even in the Eastern European states that are actually, you know, much more at risk through the dependency, because that makes actually Russia stronger? I mean, it's paradox, right? But is nuclear energy also had, does it have a kind of cultural value in a way that, you know, of, you know, a civilatory purpose? And, you know, it shows that, you know, you are able to handle those big things, and that makes you a very important, you know, country, in contrast to, you know, a couple of solar cells and wind turbines, which is kind of smaller scale. So is it to understand the situation, why that kind of paradoxical situation happens? Is that also something that has something to do with you know, culture and also, you know, economic culture, maybe? Tatiana, maybe?
Yeah, I can say that the Ukrainian case is probably a bit different, because I guess because there was so much corruption in the energy sphere that there was no sort of one big actor who would push for nuclear energy like in many other countries. And almost nuclear energy was always suffering from the corruption in other sectors. For instance, there was for the pricing of the nuclear energy, which was very cheap. The nuclear industry never got enough funds for repairs and maintenance, for instance. So it's probably not so true for Ukrainian case, but in general, and especially in Eastern Central Europe, nuclear technology is associated with the idea of countries' might and development and high tech and everything. So there's a lot of countries. I was looking into the case of Belarus, the country who received 70% of Chernobyl fallout, and why this country supports nuclear energy, which is not really needed for energy purposes, because there is this idea that anyway we suffered from nuclear energy, so we might as well at least benefit from it and build now something. So, and we should not forget that there is always this military aspect of nuclear technology often in the background. And as President Macron at some point said that, you know, both are very much connected, military and civilian, and without nuclear power plants, we will not have nuclear weapons, and without nuclear weapons, we'll not have nuclear power plants, because everything is very much connected. So this is an important aspect as well.
Thank you, Dennis.
Thank you. I will just try to give a perspective from inside the Ukraine. Because you know that probably Ukraine is one of the few, the most traumatized by nuclear incidents country, not only in region, but in the whole world. Probably only Japan could be compared, and Belarus, which already was mentioned. First of all, of course, because of Chernobyl incident, but also because of Russian blackmailing regarding Ukrainian nuclear power plants during last year, and because of some attempts of attacks to nuclear power plants on Ukrainian controlled by Ukrainian government territory. But at the same time, we could see that the general perception of nuclear energy in Ukraine is rather positive, it's rather optimistic, we would say. And that's also because of another case, how whole energy sphere, whole electricity sphere is related to human rights issues as well, and wider to the well-being during the conflict. Because you know that this winter probably was the hardest and the most difficult winter for Ukrainian society, and first of all for Ukrainian civilians in the big cities. For example, our organization did a report, a small report. It is not public yet, unfortunately, because we did it for one of the UN agencies regarding the human rights violations, which appears in which are represented in public health problems, which appears due to Russian attacks on Ukrainian energy system, and some of those things were had absolutely terrible consequences, especially for elderly people in big cities, for vulnerable groups, for people with disabilities. And we already can see that hundreds of deaths and a lot of suffering was created by Russian attacks on Ukrainian energy system. And those attacks were conscious. We all know that the situation which appeared in Odessa or in Kiev, it was part of the attempt of psychological pressure on Ukrainian society. And of course, because of that, you would be accepted in quite, how to say, because of that, anti-nuclear narrative cannot be accepted inside the Ukrainian society right now, because you know we know that more than 50% of all the energy we are having right now in both on the front line and in civilian cities, countryside, it goes from our nuclear power plants. So even despite being historically traumatized by terrible nuclear incidents and nowadays by nuclear blackmailing, Ukraine still got its resilience not only from nuclear power plants, of course, but that infrastructure, at least during this terrible winter, was one of the key points how we could manage while terrible frosts were outside. So, and I think Ukrainian case here makes this topic a little bit complicated for us. Of course, the lens of human rights is the most important one. And definitely we see huge risks, extreme risks, but also some opportunities to stabilize situation when it goes really bad, as it was 1 month ago.
Thank you. Just a quick question, because it just came to my mind. So the in the unoccupied parts of Ukraine, right? So the nuclear power plants there, where's that fuel coming from? Is that also part actually of the Russian cycle? So, or how is that, or has that changed kind of since the beginning of the war, 2014? So has the switch been made for the Ukrainian reactors? Yeah, Tatiana?
I have following this process of fuel diversification more than a decade. Yeah. And it's extremely complicated process for technical reasons, because when you diversify, it doesn't mean that you just switch to another fuel. It usually means that you make the fuel from different companies function in the same reactors. And then there are all sorts of compatibility questions. So Westinghouse was developing the fuel for VVER-1000 for many, many, many decades. And then there were, of course, political reasons, because there were actors that were against this. So when the pro-Russian government would come, they would slow down this process. But now Ukraine, I think 8 of it, 15 reactors now uses Westinghouse fuel, but it doesn't mean it's only on this fuel. I don't know what is the percentage. So there is still an important number of reactors that use do not use Western health fuels, but they also use now the fuel for the VVER 440 reactors. So one reactor in Rivne station use it. So it's a very long process, and it's complicated for technical reasons and for political. And as you mentioned, this example in of France and who are opposing this presence of Western House, we see that there are so many aspects, so many actors, so many political, economical, technical, and the security aspects, that it's a very long process. You cannot just switch like this.
Yeah, thank you. So I want to get on with the next question here, which is from Hannah. He or she asked, when I hear the report from Zaporizhia, Lingen and Ems, and we covered this already, comes to mind, what if Rosatom does something similar there? The federal German government has granted Rosatom access to the fuel element factory. What is the government thinking? So we talked about this question again, but I want to turn it in a different way. It's like, you know, there are so many Ukrainian refugees in Germany right now and all over Europe, right? And there is a very strong Russian government presence, there's a Russian government presence via Rosatom in Lingen and the other, you know, in the other sites where they're joint ventures. So, you know, also maybe getting Roger here in as well. So, and then all the others. So how is the situation, you know, how many of, you know, of Rosatom personnel are in those joint ventures, aren't Lingen, and is there actually, is the risk, and maybe also Dennis, because you're looking at the human rights aspect, so is there the risk and the fear that this is actually, you know, as Jutta said, kind of an entry gate for also hybrid warfare, because this is kind of having a little embassy there of Russian, you know, possibly operatives. So how are we looking at the security aspect of Rosatom's presence in Europe?
Maybe I give a first reply. It's very critical situation. Also, when I look, for example, like Framatom, the cooperation with Rosatom, with the instrumentation and control systems, which can also be used for military purposes. So if Framatom delivers such systems to Rosatom, that means that potentially a French industry gives control tools which can be used in nuclear reactors to produce energy, but also can be used for military purposes. The situation is also when you ask, especially in France, you ask either the government or the ministries or the companies why they are still doing business with Rosatom, the reply is always the same. There are no sanctions. As long as there are no sanctions in place, we will continue the business as usual. We suspect also that, for example, some French workers from French companies, that they are actively working in Russia because they want to deliver some control systems there for the construction of or in Russian reactors. So they must be present there, and also, as mentioned before, I think it's very critical that Rosatom employees would come to Lingen and work in the same building or the same building as German or German French employees.
Thank you very much.
Just a short comment on the same matter, but we also need to pay attention on huge Russian influence inside IAEA, for example, because as you may know, the deputy director general and the second person after the Rafael Grossi is Mikhail Chudakov, who was head of the Department of Nuclear Energy since February 2015, and he's the clear Russian diplomat and Rosatom person, and as we can assume, the second person in such organization as IAEA at some point could be even more influential than the first person, because you know the all the main documents, they go on, sometimes not through somebody who is signing papers, making photos, but through his first deputy director. So here also, not only in Linden, but also in Vienna, the Russian nuclear influence is extremely strong.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you very much. I just want to highlight one
just,
thing.
Just to add what, what Dennis said about the International Atomic Energy Agency, it's clear it's a very, very critical or sensitive issue. On the one hand, Rafael Grossi criticizes Russia because of the occupation of Zaporizhia, and on the other hand, Grossi travels around the world to promote nuclear power and to give new business opportunities to Rosatom.
Right, I'm just going through the questions here to see whether there's anything we haven't covered yet. We've done quite well, I'd say. I mean, one of the questions, so is in terms of, you know, nuclear waste as well. I mean, there's a big discussion in Germany about where to permanently store nuclear waste, and you know, this has been, you know, in Germany it's always big because we're looking for a place and people can't find one. So how's that? The question is, I think from Dieter was the question, where is Ukraine, where's your Russia, and where's France storing their nuclear waste? So what is the waste question, Tatiana?
What frustrates me with the question of waste is usually what is discussed as waste in public debate is a very narrow category of nuclear discards. It's basically usually the nuclear fuel, spent fuel assemblies from reactors or the products of their processing. And this is indeed the sort of the most toxic part of the nuclear materials used, nuclear waste, nuclear discards, but it's still a very narrow framing of the problem. And as Roger, for instance, he showed in this the complexity of nuclear fuel cycle, and this is this scheme is already a simplification, and there are so many different discards that are produced at every level that never feature in public debates as nuclear waste. You know, there is this byproducts of uranium enrichment, depleted uranium, that is basically in most of the countries just stored or even imported to Russia. There were all this protests in Germany recently about the exports of depleted uranium to Russia, and they are considered as resource because it can be enriched, but they're never used as such. Or, for instance, the waste from accidents is never really considered as waste, and accidents are never framed in this problems of waste. So there are sort of different you know, waste policies and in these countries. And in Ukraine, for instance, most of the waste, 99% of the radioactive waste is in the Chernobyl exclusion zone, both as, you know, the leftovers of the reactors which are now covered by the new safe confinement, which is no longer safe because Russian drone damaged it in February. But then Ukraine also has uranium mining operations, so there is a lot of uranium mining residues from Soviet era that are not considered as waste. France is also has this very long-term process of siting nuclear repository, and there is no basically operating nuclear repository for high-level waste in the world. The only one which is close to completion is in Finland. So Countries do have repositories and they store some waste, but it's only a small fraction of nuclear discards that nuclear technology produce, both military and civilian.
Yeah, I remember like 20 years ago when I started to kind of become politically active and going into those topics, I actually heard a talk from a scientist, but also a local leader, I think in Africa, I think in the Congo, where there's a big mine, about the situation there and how much actually that they build a dam to hold the radioactively, you know, contaminated water. And then this dam was leaking into the village and stuff like that. So this is like, this is the one I feel that this is one part of the nuclear chain and the supply chain that is often missed, because this is often actually in developing in the global south and in developing countries, this is not really visible. It's just there. The uranium somehow comes, but it's not that way. It's actually, it's a pretty far away, and this is often also not priced in if they say it's, you know, it's climate neutral somehow, you know, if you consider what damage it does to those regions. We also have a couple of questions about ecocide question, also about the dam. I think that's also very important. And I just put in the chat some from the Q&A as well as a little hint and something that happened. Maybe Dennis, you can comment on that, because this was from Dieter Kaufmann in the chat about a Ukrainian journalist who actually reported in Zaporizhia at the nuclear power plant and was arrested and tortured and died at 28. So it was in a German newspaper. I don't know how you know the case, but I wanted to share it with all of you here, because I think that shows also how dangerous the work, Dennis, you are doing and your colleagues in Ukraine are doing. And the situation is, it's life-threatening also for the people trying to figure out what's happening there. So again, big respect and this information on here. And we have 8 minutes to go, and I probably want to try and see whether there are any hands. So do we have any oral question? Anything we missed in the written question that you want to emphasize? Maybe there are hands going up. So I will try. I'll try to give only two or three people the permission to speak here. So I have one hand from Thomas. Thomas Schucker should now be able to answer the question. Thomas, actually two Thomases now. Very funny. Thomas Schucker, you have the floor. Yes. You can answer and ask in German or English, also auf Deutsch gerne.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Simple question. Could we have a link to Roger's slides, please?
I'm sure that is manageable. Thank you, Thomas. And then another Thomas Herold.
To reply, yeah. I will send you the presentation, and then you can check how to transfer it to the participants.
Excellent. Yeah, well, definitely. There will be a follow-up email with all the links, also links from Tatiana and from Dennis and from everyone. They're going to do a little link collection at the end of each webinar, so you're all very well informed. So Thomas Herold has another question, has a hand up. Thomas, you can unmute yourself now and stummen.
Hi, I hope you can hear me. So I've heard that only in Finland nuclear power plants are safe, or the cycle is supposed to be safe. What's the difference between Finland and the rest of the world?
So for Jutta, thanks, Thomas.
Jutta would like to take the question. I think it was not about security or safety, because Finland has Olkiluoto, the last power plant that was built, and again that was exceeding the budget. It took a lot longer to build it, and now when it was started there were troubles as well. So I think it's running for 2 years now, but what was meant is that Finland is the only country having a real repository. So it's a big advantage. I learned that they have a certain mountain range made of granite, and within this granite, which is really cubics of of stone. They put in copper barrels, and in the barrels is the waste, and it's 3,000 meters deep in the earth. And I mean, you never know, but this is pretty safe, or as safe as it gets, because granite does not permeate water, or water cannot permeate. And they really said, okay, the region said, yes, we apply for this repository. The granite also shields off the radiation, even if the copper is gone. So Finland has a finite repository, but said, no, we are not taking anyone else's waste. It's just enough for the Finnish waste. Thank you for the clarification. Yeah, that's a lot better than an old salt pit. Thank you, Thomas. Now there's a third Thomas asking a question. Don't know how that came about. So, Thomas, you get the last chance to ask a question. I think you are from Hungary, I suppose. And apologies, I probably cannot pronounce your last name, Kurt Velesi, but probably that was wrong. But you have the floor. Wasn't that bad, Kurt Velesi? It's actually, Hungarian is actually an e-language, but I have a little question. And, well, I followed several discussions, and time and again, people said, we are just witnessing a nuclear game between the US, Russia, Iran, and the question was raised, what can we do in opposition? So, and only, I mean, France and Britain have nuclear weapons, but just a small stock. So how can we solve this question? On the one hand, we know that nuclear power is crazy and a huge risk. At the same time, we are surrounded by gangsters who do not shy away from making use of nuclear weapons. I know it's very difficult to answer that question in 3 minutes, but I wanted to ask it at least. Thank you, Thomas. Who would like to take the question? Yes, it is truly a complicated situation and very hard to give a brief answer. But what you can see here is a connection between the civil use and the military use of nuclear power. And if you disregard Ukraine for a moment and look to Iran, the main reason, or one of the main reasons for the war in Iran, is nuclear power or the enrichment of uranium. Western countries, including France, were the first to transfer technology to Iran. And in this case, this is also about using the facilities and the different technologies. Tatiana, you have the floor.
I have a short answer. I think we do need an anti-nuclear renaissance. We do need to have a anti-nuclear movement as it was in the 70s, a movement that was really connecting different sides of nuclear technology and explaining what it means. And anti-nuclear activists today do a tremendously important work, but there are not enough of them. We need much more. Please join the anti-nuclear movement, or at least some nuclear information, which is less fragmented and more complex, so we can understand and make choices about nuclear technologies.
Thank you very much. I think this was a very good way to finish our discussion. I want to thank you all. I want to thank the audience, still 400 people in the room, or our four guests, our interpreters. I want to send special solidarity and thoughts also to Dennis and all the people in Ukraine, our Ukrainian brothers and sisters that have such a hard time under the Russian invasion. And I really hope that, you know, that they're personally hope that with maybe sanctions into the nuclear sector, there might also be more pressure that can be put on Russia to stop what they are doing immediately in Ukraine. I think that, you know, to save lives, this is the most important thing we can do now to put more pressure on the Russian invader. Right, I think Jutta was, Dennis wanted to say, okay, you, Dennis, you want to have the last word, you're very welcome to.
No, it's just a small call because you said about solidarity and I'm very grateful, but probably we need also to think about those which are now in the most like dangerous and vulnerable position. And for example, there are still 14 DNPP workers who are still in Russian captivity as civilian prisoners of war, and we almost don't know anything about the state of their health, about if they are alive. And probably it's one of the most important things is to emphasize and be as loud as possible about those people whose families are waiting for them in Ukraine or Europe.
Thank you, Dennis. Thank you all. Have still a good evening and see you at the next Europe Calling. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.